home education and this very notion that parents have not only a moral obligation, but an investment return on ensuring that their children capture who the parents are as human beings, their children are sort of being the viral vector of remembrance, the viral vector of who you were as a parent, whether good or bad, unfortunately, but who you were as a parent. And that's one of the primary investment philosophical things that we have to do as parents. So if they're not paying attention to their children in the evenings or the weekends or guiding them in books, and if they don't do that, I think they're robbing their children of this 5,000-year, very noble lineage of autonomous education of children so they could become responsible adults as a result of the household they're from and not the state they belong to.
Start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith and the artist reflected in their art, they forge their creativity closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart.
Okay, everybody, I am very pleased to welcome to School Sucks Podcast for the first time, Bill Buppert of ZeroGov.com. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how are you? It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, like I said to you when we were warming up here, I have spent the last couple days listening to interviews that I downloaded off ZeroGov, or discussions, I should say, more discussions. One with Ben Stone, one with Michael Dean, and like I said, I can't believe I've never had this man on the show before. You know, there's so much good stuff that we can go over together, so I'm really glad that you're here.
Well, good. Thank you. And like I said, this is just terrific. I think we're going to have a wonderful conversation.
So here's where I wanted to start. Even though all the interviews that I listened to weren't really they weren't covering what I planned to talk to you about, which was home education, I certainly got a very good idea why at some point you decided my children should not be in these public schools, right? Just from listening to the topics that you covered with Michael and Ben. And Jeff, I'm interested first, maybe before we get into that, if you could just tell people who are unfamiliar with your work a little bit about your background, and then we can get into the decision to do home education.
Well, without trying to riff off Dr. Evil in Austin Powers,
sure.
At the age of 17, I'd grown up in a trailer park community in which we kept tires on our roof. So I grew up rather poor and impoverished. And I was a high school dropout, didn't have many aspirations. I joined the U.S. Navy at the time. And as a result of that, I got my commission later on in the Army after going to college, after getting out of the Navy. And I spent all of my adult life in the Legions, in the military industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And I discovered probably in the mid-90s, while I was still in uniform, that there was a lot of cognitive dissonance going on intellectually, philosophically, spiritually, and I was starting to really come out of my shell and make some discoveries via Rothbard and Mises and other Austrian and libertarian scholars and abolitionist scholars like Lysander Spooner, that there's another way, there's another viewpoint, there's another worldview. And from there, I started to make these rather radical leaps. And then I find myself here today talking to Brett at the School Sucks Project and podcast about my own journey. So my journey is unique, but what I draw from it is the same thing that General Smedley Butler drew from his 3 decades of military service, which is that war is a racket, and that war is the health of the state, but that if we're smart about war and we're smart about the military, we're better able to either harness it or stop it altogether.
Okay, let's talking about harnessing it. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that you can't, what you've discovered probably, Brett, I'm being presumptuous, is that in examining the school system, your previous occupations within the school system, whether it's medical or educational, gave you an edge because of the inside knowledge that you gained from having been in there. And then when you step outside of that bubble and examine it with the knowledge that you gained by being inside the machine, you are better able to assess how to either neutralize it or eliminate it.
Absolutely. And obviously the first realization is reaching the people who are stuck inside it. Initially, when I started talking to people about some of my issues with school, they're like, oh, great, you know, so we need school reform. I'm like, no. That was the very first thing that I think I addressed on the show, is that the system is unreformable because it does exactly what it is supposed to do, I believe, for all of the powerful vested interests.
Brett, that's such a powerful notion when you say that, because you can expand that in the macro level to the Constitution. As you know from having either read my writings or listened to me speak, I consider the Constitution to probably be one of the most devilishly clever instruments to make a slave people assume that they are free that has ever been witnessed in the history of Western mankind. So in the smaller level, what the education system is doing is it is doing exactly what the Constitution, an engine for big government, for Leviathan government, for the biggest government we could possibly have on Earth. It is probably almost one of the lifeblood streams of maintaining this fiction that the slave people are free, and they do it through the government education process.
Are you referencing primarily the work of Spooner, or what's your take on that? How is that accomplished?
You know, I'm writing two books this year. I'm finishing up a novel, and my second book is going to take all 2,600 pages and six volumes of Lysander Spooner's collected work and elucidate that and analyze it into one volume for people, which hasn't been done yet. And I'm also the president of my self-proclaimed Lysander Spooner Foundation, and Lysander Spooner happens to be the patron saint of my site, zerogov.com.
Right.
It's been Lysander Spooner, it's been the Anti-Federalist, it's been Samuel Adams, it's been my study of the Articles of Confederation, it's been my study of 18th century history. And when I look at all of that, and then I look at the result of this constitutional monster that was foisted onto this part of the North American continent, it is the exact opposite of what I was trained and indoctrinated with in the government education gulags. You know, I've had to invest a considerable amount of time, having a master's degree now, but having had a bachelor's degree, of course, in deprogramming myself from tens of thousands of hours of this indoctrination and parchment idolatry. I've had to spend a considerable amount of my own time through critical thinking, critical examination, revisionism, trying to unscrew this kind of worldview that was plugged into my brain in the first half of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very powerful, and it's sad how many people just can't seem to unplug fully from it, you know? And that was one of the great realizations that I had when I was working in education, just how powerful this system, and I've said this on the show before, that for 15,000 hours of a young person's life tells you when you can speak and tells you when you can use the bathroom. In addition to all of its other programming, even outside of the curriculum, just the milieu itself, what would not appear to be freedom after that?
Indeed, it seems so simple and intuitively obvious, but in the end, you arrive at the conclusion that aside from Grove City College and Hillsdale College, and I would attend neither, by the way, those are the only two non-public post-secondary school education schools in the nation. That's it. All the rest are tax-funded. If you accept one Pell Grant at one university for one student out of your 5,000, 35,000 population, that entire 35-kilometer baggage train of taxes, regulatory behavior, and government nonsense follows that student in the door, and every student on that campus must abide.
Yeah, yeah. And I try to tell just what I could refer to as outsiders I try to explain how revolutionary what people like me or you are actually doing with this media, because the state fights a war on all fronts against, basically the freedom of individuals. They've got everything covered, you know, like what are the real revolutionary forces in the world as far as I'm concerned? And I'm obviously open to adding to this list. One, I think, is science. One, I think, is education. And the other is the arts and media, right? The state controls them all, you know, and you would think that even if people recognize that, yeah, there's a bunch of bureaucracy and a fair degree of indoctrination in the secondary school system, they see higher education as the place where, okay, this is where it really begins, you know? And
it's the finishing school for the mind laundry.
Exactly.
It is.
I really felt like, as far as a political belief system was concerned, that college was the nails in the coffin, right? And we were talking about this before we started. When I was 21 years old, I was not thinking. I told you about a little bit about this experience that I had in this boarding school. Mm-hmm. I did it because I felt like I had a duty to contribute to society, to give back for the, and I don't know, people could attach, labels like white guilt to this, which is certainly, they teach that in college, I'm going to do the noble thing and, take less money, but help people out. And it was a real wake up call between the ages of like 21 and 23, how the state helps people, and how corrupt that is. So
we could call it collectivist guilt. I think that would be more explanatory.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A duty to contribute to society is very like middle 19th century German idealist kind of thinking to me.
And to be a dutiful soldier ant.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
So we know where that ideology takes people as well.
I find it interesting where. When we study Prussian society and the German influence on education, it's all very well and good to poo-poo that and say, well, there were a lot of negative things to that, and we should throw that out altogether. But I would tell you that Gary Taubes, who wrote Why We Get Fat, which is a popularized distillation of his earlier epic tome called Good Calories, Bad Calories, all the stuff that he taught me, for instance, about getting my diet under control and maintaining my fighting trim and fitness was divined from German studies that had been done 100 years ago that told us that wheat is bad, fat is good, and all these basic things that the USDA and the AMA in America do just the opposite of. We find in libertarian circles, if I do just the opposite of what the nutrition czars tell me in the government to do, I'm a healthier person. Same thing applies when it comes to the practitioners of warfare. If you don't pay attention to what the Germans did, despite this 12-year National Socialist interregnum from 33 to 45 in the 20th century, if you don't pay attention to the German way of war, you're not going to be very successful in the prosecution thereof or the defense from other armies around the world, because they really did break the code on how that's done. So I guess my cautionary tale here is that just because Gatto claims that it is based on a Prussian-style system doesn't mean that we should throw the cultural baby out with the bathwater, because the Germans are uniquely gifted in an engineering, scientific, and even a cultural sense in providing the world with disproportionate rewards and gifts, much like the Scots have.
That's a really interesting perspective, and I think I've often overlooked that when I think about how things wound up there by the middle of the 20th century. I mean, not to undermine the people who suffered or make light of the horrors that took place in Central Europe before and during World War II, but if you just hit a few bullet points about the Nazis, they kind of look like cartoon bad guys,
they do.
They're just these
But it's to their advantage too.
Absolutely.
It's to the advantage of the West to portray them in that fashion. And no one here is making apologies for any state excesses between you and I. I'm certain of that. But we look at the National Socialist death tolls, which were in the tens of millions,
right,
and there's no excuse nor apology to give for it. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article a while back called Befehl ist Befehl, which means orders are orders, which was the Nuremberg defense.
Right.
And the point that I was making is that here we have the Germans who are vilified, almost like cartoon characters like you're talking about. Yet we have police forces on the streets of America who work for the state, who use the very same tactics and have the very same disregard for large swaths of American society. And their excuse is the same excuse that saw people hanged at the Nuremberg war trials.
Yeah, and it all operates in the same ideological container, which we've already addressed, which is collectivism,
Thank you, Brett, for clarifying that, because National Socialism and Communism are kissing cousins.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wanted to go back to lessons from the Prussian state or even the German state and the contributions that are there. And even if there are things like, obviously, there are tremendous positive contributions from that part of the world. But even the things that most people like us would see as negative, like von Clausewitz, are you familiar with?
Very much so.
Yeah, right. I figured that you would be. And this idea of the war on all fronts and how there's lessons for people who are trying to forward the ideas of liberty, not just in like, hey, here's how you need to defend yourself, because here is a strategy that obviously has a track record of being successful, but it's a strategy that can be used by us as well. Right. So,
well, the unique and modest contribution that I can make here, because of having spent my adult life in the legions, mm-hmm. is concurrent with your experience. You were inside the belly of the beast. You know how the belly of the beast operates, its machinations, its Machiavellian ambitions, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
I know that too. And when I was at Porkfest, I gave a 4-hour seminar on irregular warfare practice and history, in which I showed them how revolutionary movements function, how they work. And in February, I did a talk at the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire, as a matter of fact, on underground resistance and nonviolent resistance, like Gandhi's Satyagraha campaigns in the 1920s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. There's a lot of value to study. You know, history rhymes. It doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. And we have this unique capability where we have this bloodless practicum that's thousands of years old, whether we're looking at education, the military, or whatever milieu you specialize in the libertarian or liberty movement, you can use history as a guide on what to do, what not to do, what to prescribe, what to prescribe, and what is the virtuous path to take. Let's say there's 3% of the population is responsible for a revolutionary movement and making that revolutionary movement successful.
Mm-hmm.
In order for that to happen, you have to have a real good read on history. The German General Staff, after 1806, had, when they conducted their operational and strategic level campaigns, and when I say that, I have to make this slight correction. Germany didn't become a country until 1870, so we're talking about the Prussian General Staff that eventually became the German General Staff under both von Moltkes. They had a historian on staff, and they would never conduct or plan any operations whatsoever without examining historical campaigns that had occurred before them, to sort of like conduct an after-action review and say, what worked, what didn't work, and what are we going to do for this scenario that we're embracing? You talk about 911.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned in another program that I'll bet you listened to when I was with Michael that since 1526, no Muslim nation has invaded any Christian or Western nation.
Right.
But since 1526, dozens of Muslim nations have been invaded by the West. If one puts oneself in the boots, shoes, or sandals of the people being invaded, the people being occupied, would some of them resist? Of course they would, because it's another notion I have. Secession isn't the exception. That is the rule of history. That's how countries come to be. You know, these United States from 1775 to 1783, those were divorce proceedings from the United Kingdom. That was a secessionist movement. The Second American Revolution in 1860, not successful because of Lincoln and the rest of it, but we're all paying for the piper now, because what Lincoln secured was not only did he get every American on the plantation, North and South, but he paved the way and made the way secure for progressivism to take a very vicious, deep, and vital hold on the American psyche that we still suffer from today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's like the best presidents are the worst, you know?
They are. You know, one of my favorites, if I can say it's a favorite, is Grover Cleveland and Martin Van Buren, probably. And I put Lincoln, Red D.R., Woodrow Wilson. I mean, they're just, it's just awful what they do. The scope of their depravity and criminal behavior against human life is astonishing to me.
Absolutely. So since we're going down this road, before we get into the whole home education conversation, one of the things that I've been exploring recently, because obviously from what I've heard from you today and in the previous interviews, is that, you know, your knowledge of history is incredible. I'm always impressed by how people can be in a conversation and then just start recalling, you know, these things and pulling them in and making them relevant. I have a really hard time with that. I listen back to myself sometimes and I go, oh, why didn't I say this? Why didn't I bring up that? I knew this. You know, I'm
we
impressed.
We always have that, Brett, all of us.
I'm impressed with myself that I remembered von Clausewitz and how he fit into this conversation. But one of the questions that I always like when people as knowledgeable as you are on the show, one of the things I like to ask is about historical lenses. Do you find yourself having a, like, history is a movie scene that can be filmed and lit any way, basically, which is why we wind up with all these different or even conflicting versions of historical events or time periods. do you find yourself viewing history through a specific lens?
I absolutely do. From a historiographical perspective, if I may, a preamble, very quick preamble.
Yeah, yeah.
I consider myself an abolitionist, which means I'm an anarchist, but I use the term abolitionist because it provides me with a means of not using a term that is so politically and philosophically charged as anarchist, especially for people who aren't familiar with the term. It really puts them off. So I've adopted the term abolitionist. Because I'm an abolitionist, I don't participate in party factions. I don't participate in the political process. Because of my divorcing myself from that, it's made me rather agnostic and stripped away any kind of partisan factionalism that I would attend to, like I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, I'm a liberal, I'm a communard, I'm a libertarian even. I've divorced myself from that. So my historiographic lens is that why do bad actors in history who assume the helm of the state do the things that they do, and they do it for this very simple reason. I know this sounds like it's from the University of the Intuitively Obvious, and it is.
Right.
They do it to maintain and expand the power at their disposal and to continue that into the future. That's it. That's all it is. That's why the title of my book is Zero Gov, Limited Government, Unicorns, and Other Mythological Creatures, because limited government is an impossibility in the human sphere.
Yeah. I was going to just briefly describe my development, right? That, I mean, obviously college was a big wake up where you kind of discard the Disney version of history that you get in public school for something that is more of like a new left Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky kind of lens. And that was really valuable for me. 9/11 happens. It wakes me up to the fact that, okay, well, just because I studied history doesn't mean that I'm done, right? Because here's this whole geopolitical event that I don't understand at all. And I think I started to get into shows like Complete Liberty, Free Talk Live, Free Domain Radio between like 2006 and 2008. Obviously, that took this collage that I had, you know, just all this information and made it a mind map, you know, put something at the center that everything else was kind of moving around. And that was essentially the philosophy of liberty. It's funny, though, like I was just to speak to what you just said, I was like, I realized how naive I was even in 2009. Now, I would have self-described as a libertarian, probably an anarcho-capitalist at the time.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama getting elected and saying, I wonder if these guys who are leaving office are going to get tried for war crimes. You know, like it's amazing. That was 5 years ago. That does seem very naive, but also Barack Obama was clearly different than anyone else who had been president before. So I don't know. I had this like glimmer of hope, not that he would make the country better with his progressive ideas. I knew that wasn't going to happen. But I was like, wait a minute. Are they going to go after these guys? Because Biden Biden says things. That's kind of what he does. And they're usually pretty out there. But he hinted in an interview, I think between the election and the inauguration, that there might be some feet that were about to get held to the fire for Iraq. So just to speak to your comment of, you know, the idea is to consolidate power and then protect it, you know, and expand it, obviously. That was like the final realization for me that all of this power that had been taken between 2001 and 2009 was now going to be used by people claiming to have the opposite ideology for essentially the same purposes and new purposes. So change for Obama meant like all the bad stuff that Bush did. I think people thought change meant not the bad stuff that Bush did, but it meant all the bad stuff that Bush did plus new bad stuff that we've come up with, right? So,
well, this is Bush's fourth term.
Yeah, it really is. That really upsets Obama.
You know what? What you just said in the last minute, if your audience leaves with anything, I want them to burn that into their brains. Mm-hmm. That what we have here is an occupation force in government. That's what government's been since 1791 on our little piece of our little tax jurisdiction on the North American continent. So if they pull back and dispense with all the petty factionalism that the state loves, by the way, they love us to get into these camps and call ourselves, well, you're Republicans, you're Democrats, sort of like the Judean people's friend and the people's friend of Judea from Monty Python. They love to have that kind of internal struggle among the tax cattle, because what it does is it distracts them from the main distraction that's occurring altogether, which is government having its hands in their pockets and a gun to their head and guiding them like like farm animals to do exactly what the government wishes them to do.
Right. Stay busy fighting with each other so you can never recognize your true enemy.
That's why you're a dangerous man, Brett, with this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. So we've talked now for about 20 minutes, and I think we've certainly established this foundation where my listeners can understand why you were never going to send children of your own to government school. And this was when Ben Stone introduced me to your work a few months ago. One of the first things he told me about, obviously, was that you had done homeschooling. And yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about not just how you decided to do that, but what that was like in your home. So what was the process of making the decision? And then what is home education to you? Those are two things that I would like to address.
Terrific. I have five children, and now I have six because I have a daughter-in-law mm-hmm. who happens to be from Indonesia, who I'm urging my oldest son not to get her U.S. citizenship, by the way.
Right.
But and they plan on homeschooling their children, by the way, my oldest son, once they have children. They're both engineers. We began this because all of our children are different. How many children do you have, Brett? Do you have any?
I don't have any children.
Children? Okay. Well, then you've been exposed to people who have children who have taken this very difficult decision.
Right.
Another preamble, I come from a very impoverished background, but my marriage with my wife, Lilo, for whom I'm the exchequer, and she's done the lion's share of the very meritorious homeschool education and work for our children, she stayed at home. She just started working a month ago for the first time in two decades mm-hmm. because we became a single income family, which is a rara avis in American society. It comes with some financial and economic privation as a result of not having that second income, but we were so dedicated to the proposition that none of our children would go to a government school and we would not surrender their minds for 8 to 12 hours a day, 5 days plus a week to this alien institution that whose only purpose was to turn them into effectively complacent tax cattle. So I think that that's what informed our initial decision to do it. As we had more children, we also started to homeschool those children. We've had various success with it, by the way. You know, the one thing I think the home education movement needs to be seriously revelatory about is that homeschooling doesn't always work to the goals that you wish it would.
Right.
With my oldest son, it's been incredible because he's a natural learner. He loves learning. He finished his BS in mechanical engineering. He finished his MS in mechanical engineering. He's a successful mechanical engineer in Northern Utah as we speak. My middle son is a firefighter who loves reading, but he never thought that college would be the thing for him. And I tried to discourage him from entering the military, which was one of his ambitions, because I tried to discourage all my children from doing that.
Yeah.
He's happy in his new firefighter vocation up in Washington State. And he's a constant reader. As a matter of fact, one thing I do for my children is that books are the primary medium, probably 90% of the medium for transmitting civilizational information so that we can become thinking, critically thinking individuals and autonomous individuals and hopefully libertarian individuals. I can happily say that all three of my sons, I have three sons, two daughters, all three of my sons are dyed-in-the-wool abolitionists, and that my two daughters are libertarians who have not quite gotten there yet. But there's a gender gap that we can discuss later on when it comes to ANCAP and abolitionism that I think is in the movement that needs to be addressed by someone smarter than me.
Sure.
My youngest son, he's not, there's seven different styles of learning. He's not quite ambitious as a learner, but he's 17 now. He should finish. My oldest daughter finished her degree in anthropology. She's living in Colorado. That was successful. And my youngest daughter, who's been going to community college since she's been 15, with correctives given to us by us at home with her studies and such, she's been rather successful too, and she's still pursuing her collegiate career, and she's still rather young. But the home education thing for us was that we wanted to make sure that the memes and the intellectual development of our children was solely in our hands. It wasn't in the hands of complete strangers whose agenda was completely alien to the agenda that we have. Because what I found with most government education and these education gulags is that their primary intention is to rob them of critical thinking skills, to rob them of a love of learning, and to rob them, by the way, of a love of reading things that are outside of the accepted scope For instance, I consider myself a revisionist historian, so the history that we teach our children has been pretty different from what they would get in the government gulags. I had a library annex on my house that we used to have a house, but we sold it because we've liquidated all our real estate assets in the U.S. I used to have a library annex on the house. So my wife and I are readers. All our children except one are very avid readers, and they grew up in a reader household. 20 years ago, we stopped all broadcasts and satellite communications into the house via television.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We've only had streaming, that kind of thing. So I guess that's that would be a nutshell of what we've done. But I want to emphasize, if it weren't for my wife, Lilo, me being the exchequer and working the day job and such and giving her the help that I could, if it weren't for her, none of this home education would have occurred. So yeah. I thank her all the time for that.
Yeah, you know, that was another thing, too. When you first started this process together, were you solely worried about the curriculum? Obviously, it's a huge concern for somebody with your knowledge that, this is not what you want being forced on kids day in and day out. But you mentioned the work of Gatto earlier, and one of the really the great insights that I got from reading books like, first of all, well, The Underground History of American Education, or even the books that deal more with his experience as a teacher, like Dumbing Us Down, is he doesn't let his books really be dominated by criticisms of curriculum. It's more about the environment itself. And, you know, one of the things that I often encourage people when they have questions about doing home education, I got this great little soundbite from Laurette Lynn, the Unplugged Mom, who said, you know, don't call it homeschooling. You can't do school at home. Only school can be school. And one of the goals of my show is to really make it clear that schooling and education are not synonyms, right? They're more like antonyms. So in addition to that advice, I've also talked to people about, even if you want to use terms like unschooling, where education is just this free-form, open-ended, completely child-driven process, and there still are a lot of things about that that I like, but now I've kind of started to wonder more about some proactive environmental controls that are really necessary. And it sounds like your home had them, right? Like you were able to create an environment that would be educational. So that's really good to hear. And I'd also like to hear maybe a little bit about, if there was a curriculum, where did it come from? How did you adapt it? How, maybe if there's distinct differences from child to child with what you were doing, right? So, I mean, the problem with school is it's one size fits all. So you have five children, how was that managed? I would love to hear about that.
Gosh, Brett, what a great question. But I've got to address this because it's so critical what you're doing by being linguistically specific, by mm-hmm. practicing this kind of specificity. Because yes, you're right. I shouldn't use the word schooling, because I agree with you I've just had a brain zapper that it is an antonym to education. For instance, our language informs not only our learning, not only our education, but the way we view the world. For instance, how many people do you hear say the United States is instead of these United States are? Just those first three words that people say without thinking about it, they assume it's a top-down, centrally planned, centrally directed entity that is and always has been that way.
Right.
When we use the three words, these United States are, it's different. It's sort of like when we use the word should and we use any word but I in front of it, the presumption that we're making is that I have the right to tell Brett what to do with his wealth, time, and resources, and if he doesn't like it, I have the ability to threaten you with violence or use violence to force you to do what I want you to do.
Mm.
So I just want to say, Brett, thank you for clarifying that. I think it's terrific. Home education in my house, we adopted the variations on unschooling, the Charlotte Mason method, and the trivium and the quadrivium.
Excellent.
For those audience members who aren't aware of it, or if you want me to give a quick précis of each, it's obvious what unschooling is, which is where we did not use complete unschooling, because I'm something of a skeptic of complete unschooling.
Sure, yeah.
But I do think that unschooling, for instance, my oldest son was an aviation buff. So the unschooling thing we do is that he would build aircraft models. I would take him to aircraft museums. When we were in Germany, he went up in a glider when he was age 13 or 14, I think it was, where he got the actual aviation experience. Whatever he wanted, he got to feed that enthusiasm that he had for that. One thing I do for all my children, for instance, now, even after they've left the house, because I have only one left in the home, is that if they want a book and it's within reason, I'm going to buy that book for them. For instance, my middle son said, "Hey, Dad, you've always had the 54 volumes of the great books of the Western world. I'd like my own set." And I said, "You know what? I'll get you the 10-volume gateway to the great books. You let me know how you like that." He responds to me a month later and says, "Hey, Dad, I love this." So I find used, by the way, mm-hmm. and there's some brilliant investments you can make for like $100 to get these 54 volumes. I find it used on eBay and mail it to his home. So he totes around 64 volumes of the great books of the Western world. All our children have read Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book, you know, because we like to be really foundational. The Charlotte Mason method is, instead of using textbooks, you use whole books, which is that we would take historical fiction like Laura Ingalls Wilder, the libertarian, by the way, mm-hmm. and other books, and it would provide them with historical snapshots that would not only involve history, but the craft of writing, the craft of reading, how that works. We tried a variety of methods because of the different learning styles among our children for math, like Saxon math worked for some, switched on Schoolhouse worked for others. So we'd experiment and see what suited the learning style of the child. And of course, with the trivium and the quadrivium, the great thing about teaching Latin, which my wife did, is that Latin may be a supposed dead language, but what Latin does is it has an almost mathematical precision and accuracy to its implementation and learning. And math, also in addition to that, helps to train you to think critically. It helps people to train to use this muscle that is their mind in ways that they may not use. And also, we try to teach out of the box. So I think that sort of sums it up.
Yeah, I actually taught math for a couple of years at the secondary level, and that was the best answer that I could come up with. Certainly, it was algebra and some geometry, and of course the famous student to teacher question: when would we ever use this? I said, yeah, never. But we're on treadmills. Our minds are on treadmills. This is great. Even doing things like proofs, like this is good for us to do. And I still Absolutely. Stand by that math has that value. As far as the trivium and the quadrivium, we have a series on the quadrivium coming that I haven't planned yet. I did a series on the trivium with Gino Denning. And Excellent. This is it was around this time, and looking at the work of Dorothy Sayers, I said, okay, well, wait a minute. I've been pushing unschooling. I have schooling teaching experience. I don't have any children. I've never done this. And while I still think that there's a tremendous value in an unschooling environment, I'm like, wait a minute, it might not be this cut and dry, because when we're looking at the complexity, even though I think the trivium is to a certain degree a natural process that we're always trying to put our minds through, and it's a lot harder to go through the grammar, logic, rhetoric process if we have been schooled. But to really be proficient, it is something that needs to be made explicit. It is something that I think needs to be taught. Obviously, the same is true with the quadrivium. So even though I don't think Dorothy Sayers, everything she wrote in the essay, the name is escaping me right now. I don't know if you can...
I know the one that you're talking about, and it's escaping me too, because I'm addled by my advancing antiquity, but nonetheless, I know the one you're talking about.
Right. And I think my audience might be familiar. There's probably a bunch of people who are listening to us in the future saying the name of it as we struggle. But so anyway, she kind of laid it out by, age milestones. And I saw that as actually pretty valuable. I don't like the idea that unschooling is this alleviation of responsibility from parents to, do their best to ensure a prosperous and happy future of their children, especially when their children are too young to do that for themselves. And
I have to tell you, I'm an unschooling skeptic to a certain extent for this reason. One of the primary reasons government education fails to provide critical thinking skills and cognition skills that you and I would want children to have mm-hmm. is because the only group they want to judge themselves by is this curious peer age band that they're in by the grade system, where they're within 12 to 18 months of each other in age, and they're responding to each other as humans do, almost like pack animals, within that peer age range, where that those are the people that they're going to emulate. Now, will they emulate laziness? Well, most people tend to more laziness than industriousness. That's the human condition. And if I were to unschool my children where I say, hey, hands off, you guys pursue whatever you want, they don't have the maturity, the aptitude, the experience, nor with a peer age band, the exposure to know what's going to do them well in the future. We do, because we paid the stupid tax and we're the ones who are subsidizing their education. We're the ones who are insulating them from the outside world to a certain extent and doing all those things. So I did practice unschooling in a small fraction of what we did, but I certainly wouldn't have entertained unschooling across the board. And I do think that's the brilliance of the trivium and the quadrivium.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit, maybe just as a preview, about how the quadrivium instruction went, how that was done, and maybe a little bit of some value you saw your children getting out of that.
Well, you know, what really helps is the fact that if anyone in your audience, or maybe you, Brett, have heard of the Stoic philosophers like Epictetus and Seneca, sure, and Aurelius and others, I consider myself to be a Stoic, and my three sons have become capital S Stoics. My daughters, again, the gender gap is there. Not so much, but they're familiar with it. I think that the Stoic pillar, the practical philosophy of Stoicism, really works well and marries itself well to both the trivium and the quadrivium.
Can you just give us the essence of Stoicism, too, for those who might be unfamiliar?
Certainly. The essence of Stoicism is that we are conscious beings, what Seneca said was a vessel of clay and a few quarts of blood, whose entire measure of their lifespan is their character in being good to themselves, being good to the people around them, and basically being happy by exercising things like span of control. For instance, if you're concerned about world hunger, that's wonderful. But if it worries you and makes you sick to your stomach, you have span of control issues. A Stoic wouldn't get sick to his stomach about world hunger. What a Stoic would do is a Stoic would say, in my local community, what can I do to alleviate hunger with the limited resources and finances that I have, and how far will I go? You make your own determination.
Yeah.
A Stoic isn't somebody who doesn't have emotion. A Stoic is somebody who reserves and preserves emotion for the right times. For instance, if your audience has seen the movie Gladiator, most would say Maximus, General Maximus, appears to be the Stoic character. But actually, the best Stoic character in that movie is Maximus's boss, in essence, the man who purchased him and brought him to the Roman Colosseum. Because you'll recall that at the moment of that man's death, when he's surrounded by Roman soldiers, you see him look up. He's got a look of resignation on his face, but not a look of fear. And he says, this is but dust and shadows. Because what he knows is that what he does and with his life, and when he looks in the mirror every day, is a reflection of the man that he is, hopefully a good man, a happy man. Now, can Stoicism be used as an evil medium? I think it can. But for the most part, when you look at the Stoic philosophers from the ancient Greek times, you discover that that was not the purpose and be-all of the philosophy itself. And I maintain that it is one of the only practical philosophies out there.
Yeah, I really actually, I like that. And first a thought and then a question. One of the first pieces of advice, I don't do a lot of advice on my show. We kind of put the ideas out there, and I try to be very non-prescriptive. Like, here's some things that I've learned, maybe they're useful for you. I would stand by this as advice, and I think I kind of summed it up as these spheres of control. When you talk about Stoicism, reserving emotion for the right times, and also recognizing the range of control that you might have in life. Don't set out to free the world if you have a cage in your own head. We talked before we started, I think, or maybe even it was in the beginning of the show, about the high burnout operation of trying to spread the philosophy of liberty through political or even civil disobedience means. And, I think a lot of people, you can watch this happen on Facebook, which is also a place I don't recommend for anybody, but
Nor do I, and I've never had a Facebook account.
Oh, that's great. That's a kind of freedom in itself right there. Because that is a website, if you're not ready for it, it can make a man or woman feel much smaller, right? Because it's like, here, look at this. Syria, police in Los Angeles, and it's all these things that you can do nothing about in a parade that goes on all day long. So it's very disempowering. But, you know, the spheres of control, obviously the closest and the one where we have potentially the most efficacy is with ourselves and then with our important relationships, maybe they're friends, family, or romantic, and then our community. And if we can really nail all that stuff, and it certainly takes time, I mean, they're all works in progress, I think, then maybe we can talk about like a national government. Then maybe we can talk about the Federal Reserve. But if your first operation is to get Ron Paul elected or end the Fed, and it's still a cage in your own head, that is not a recipe for success. So I like that aspect of Stoicism when it's talking about deciding where emotion needs to go and recognizing the range of control that you have. I'm guessing, I should know this, but I am honestly guessing that it was in contrast to Epicureanism, which is around the same time.
Indeed it is. Yeah. It's Epictetus versus Epicurus.
Yeah.
Epicurus. Yeah. Very good, Brett.
But is it fair to call Epicureanism more libertine?
More libertine and hedonistic.
Yes, hedonistic.
Yes.
Okay, absolutely. Absolutely. Right, yeah. Right. So, and both obviously have the same, it's not like this should surprise anyone that obviously both have happiness as the goal, right?
They do.
But it seems like my assessment of Epicureanism is like, hey, there's a fast lane. it's called wine. It's called food. You know, that kind of thing. Like you can.
The distinction between them is accountability and responsibility as an individual.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's also a powerful out. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm writing two books this year, and I'm writing two books next year. One of the books next year is going to be on the connection between ancient Stoicism and modern abolitionism and libertarianism. Here's one of the key takeaways. One of the most powerful things I've discovered in Stoicism is that Stoicism talks about the fact that, and you could read dialogues between Roman emperors and Stoics, where the Stoic says, you know what, you can ask me to do something, but if I don't want to do it, or I find it immoral or not virtuous, I'm not going to do it. Even if I do that on pain of death, I will not comply. You probably heard me talk to Ben Stone and others, or even write about it, where you can question authority, and that's really sexy and romantic, and maybe it'll get you laid by hippie chicks.
Yeah.
But in the end, you have to question obedience, because questioning authority is what you were referring to earlier. That's where people say, you know, I'm worried about world hunger, I'm worried about the state, I'm worried about the Federal Reserve. But what makes questioning authority ineffective is that if you still obey, if you still comply, you can question authority all day long and the state will smile beatifically upon you. But if you take the next Stoic step, which is you question your obedience and you say, my life is worth more than this, even if I do it on pain of death, because I'm going to live by the principle of being an autonomous individual. If that becomes a demographic tidal wave where more people start to question obedience, that is where the state is going to perish.
Yeah. So it's the Alexander Haig idea, right? Or it's credited to Alexander Haig, who I think was Reagan's chief of staff. Let them march all they want. Let them march all they want, you know?
That's right.
As long as they pay their taxes.
Yeah.
Right?
Admiral William Stockdale, who was a POW in the idiotic war in Vietnam, he used Stoicism as a way to cope with his very in delicate circumstances while he was POW by the Vietnamese.
How so? Do you have an example?
Oh, sure. He used it as a means where, you know, let me take it to Michael Collins. If anybody's seen the movie Michael Collins, and I'm something of a student of the Irish Republican Army and that kind of thing, just studying revolutionary warfare, how insurgencies works, how counterinsurgency works. In the movie Michael Collins, which took a lot of artistic license, but this was based on an actual speech, Collins is there berating a crowd and knowing that the police are closing in, and he says, and I'm paraphrasing, they can send us to the Marne because they're fighting World War I at the time, and the Marne is another one of those butcher machines that takes all these British young men and makes them assume room temperature. in these vast swaths of corpse piles. He says they can send us to the Marne, they can chain us, they can jail us, but the one thing they can't take away from us is our refusal. And I think that's what it comes down to. If you weaponize your refusal, and when I say weaponize, I mean where you say, I'm standing here, I'm not harming anybody, but I'm not going to move to comply physically, mentally, emotionally, or patriotically. I'm going to stand my ground on principle.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a lot of these faux refusals that are anything but, you know, like the Occupy movement comes to mind, right?
And I think they want the police state and they want it hard.
No, I think I heard you say this, or maybe you were talking about a meme where it's like, these are people who, on the one hand, and gosh, I've tried to explain this to people, and gosh, is it frustrating sometimes, people who are more liberal or progressive. The meme essentially was, as you described it, here's somebody, it's like a picture of an Occupy person, wants more state, right? And then across the street, there's the police, and it's like, here's more state. Yeah, and that's how it works.
Plenty of state,
and they go hand in hand. The militarization of society and the police state is so built into progressivism, which is being sold to people as equality and peace and fairness. And you know,
thank you, Brett. Thank you. You're so right. I mean, you know, you look at, I'm a non-voter,
right?
But I'm a champion of Ron Paul, and I think what Ron Paul has done for the libertarian movement in the 20th and 21st century is probably more significant than anything that's been done since Lysander Spooner and others in the 19th century. But at one point, you'll recall, Michael Kucinich, are you familiar with him?
Michael Kucinich? No, I don't. I know.
Yeah, he was, I think he's either a senator or a representative. He was going to run, but he was running as a progressive. But he and Ron Paul shared a lot of foreign policy non-intervention notions. So Ron Paul, I think, may have considered him as a running mate.
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
Oh, Dennis. Yeah, Dennis Kucinich. Yeah.
Dennis Kucinich, that's right. Excuse me.
No problem.
And so so Dennis, who has a smoking hot redheaded wife,
that's
by the way.
That's true. Interesting. Yeah.
He does. And he's a dwarf.
Yeah.
He's a misshapen, intellectually twisted little collectivist progressive dwarf. But nonetheless, when it comes to foreign policy, he said, you know, America's war on the world is wrong. It's much like Obama, which you were mentioning earlier in 2008. I thought, wow, he really wants to get us out of this world police, this war on the world we've been conducting since 1893. I'm not going to vote, but maybe I can give him a huzzah or two. Well, of course, we've seen the results of that. But Ron Paul is the only authentically pro-life candidate who really wants peace on earth. And I mean, he really wants peace on earth domestically and foreign policy-wise. The only politician and philosopher out there in the public sphere who wants that. Kucinich wants peace on earth outside of North American borders, but within the tax jurisdiction known as these United States, he is happy to impose his progressive, socialist, communard, embracing of violence at every stop to form society and have this police state. The movement and the philosophical enterprise that you and I are engaged in is pro-life across the board, and we should leave the state to be the death cult.
There's an unfortunate, it's kind of a tragedy, actually. Like, we talked about Zinn and Chomsky and people, well, I don't know if I'd put Chomsky in this camp, but Zinn definitely.
Chomsky, the self-avowed libertarian, please.
But in the 60s, there was this new left movement that seemed to, like, it's funny, I think, from what I can gather, that prior to that, like, prior to the Vietnam War protests, there was a clearer understanding than there is today of what progressivism and liberalism via FDR and the New Deal was. And the new left came along from my research as a counter to that. And it seems like over the course of the last 40 years, they've just kind of run together back into one thing. Right, where Kucinich has a lot of new left ideas and instincts that are good, but it doesn't seem like it can be pulled apart from this old progressive, you know, social control, militarization of society, at least in an economic context.
You know, it's so interesting because I think in the American character of progressivism that we see today, there was a 10-year interregnum, maybe in the 60s, but I can't quite put the snapshot where it should slide
right
in the 20th century on where they said, you know, maybe war isn't such a good idea. But when Randolph Bourne said before 1914 or 15, I think it was, war is the health of the state, Remember, it was the Democrats and the progressives who got America into World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. I make no excuse for the Republicans, because the Republicans of today, apart from the Taft wing and the members of the Anti-Imperialist League like Lindbergh and the members of the America First sentiments that we see today with Patrick Buchanan, who are outliers in the conservative spectrum, most of the conservatives, especially the neoconservatives, who probably comprise a majority of the intellectual brain trust and almost the instinctive reaction of most conservative talking heads today, like in faux news, what you discover is even they acknowledge that war is the health of the state. They need war to advance and expand the state. I've given this several times, and I hope I'm not boring your audience if they've heard me say it before, but I think it's such a signature moment that illustrates everything with a huge light bulb, and that's this. In 1917, there was an acknowledged federal debt of $500 million. In 1918, after Woodrow Wilson defied his prognostications of not entering this war in Europe, and we go into it in the fourth, the U.S. goes into it in the fourth inning in 1918, the acknowledged federal debt is increased by 16 times the amount it was prior. We find the same thing happening after World War II, the same thing happening after Korea, Vietnam. And not only do we see an expansion of the state financially, because in 1943, of course, Milton Friedman says, you know, income tax withholding is a really good idea. And Red D.R. says, hey, I'll buy into that. And of course, he and his staff implement that through his economic council. But what we discover is that war provides them not only the means to financially expand the state, but it provides them with a blank check and an e-ticket, like at Disney World, to do whatever they want in the name of the national security state, in the name of this warfare welfare state that we have within the North American confines of this tax jurisdiction. And going back to the reason why I'm on your podcast in the first place, education is the key to maintaining this, government education, by the way, is the key to maintaining this fiction that if we make war on the world, we'll all be the better for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was surprised when Thaddeus Russell first told me about a year and a half ago, first conversation I had with him.
By the way, thank you for having him on. I know that he identifies himself as sort of left of center, but he's really providing a valuable insight, I think.
Yeah, let's just touch on that for a minute before I make this point about John Dewey. That's a marker. John Dewey. Come back to John Dewey, Brett. the whole, it kind of goes back to the Stoicism versus Epicureanism thing, where there's been this rift between him and me and him and my audience, where it's kind of like, okay, this discipline is not a bad idea in itself. It's the state disciplining people or encouraging them to discipline themselves for the benefit of their rulers, right? The idea of discipline is not bad, right? We don't need to abandon the concept of discipline. He did this in the last show too with the scientific method, because it's used against us by progressives. I was like, okay, well, scientific method is not the problem. It's the use of it. It's how it's being employed as a tool. So the idea of discipline, and I tried to make this, we did a show called The Shame Debate, and I tried to make this point, like, we need to self-discipline against the state, not for the sake of the state. You know, it's not discipline itself that is bad. So it kind of, it relates back to the Stoicism philosophy, turning up self-awareness, right?
Absolutely. And self-discipline is vital to critical thinking, for instance. And critical thinking is nothing more than thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Which involves self-discipline.
Right, right. And if we kind of let ourselves atrophy, whether physically or mentally, it reduces our capability, obviously. I mean, obviously, right? So the idea of just sort of hedonism and libertinism, you're really not ready for what's out there, right? Like if you're talking about forwarding the philosophy of liberty, you're not really getting yourself in shape, whatever that means to you, to actually go out and, you know, run into what you're going to run into as you, or the challenges, you know, the obstacles that you run into as you try to push those ideas forward or share them with new people. Because,
well, I think that liberty also involves foregoing present consumption for future return. I mean, it's a basic investment precept to do that kind of thing. And what liberty asks us to do is not only should we all act in our own self-interest, but we should act in our own self-interest so that it's aggregated through a time horizon that's rather long, so everybody benefits.
Yes,
What we do in Liberty is we usually forego present consumption for future return, which is a basic precept of investing. What we try to do is we try to say a self-interested, nonviolent society is beneficial to everybody around us, and that if we exercise that self-interest all the time, by occasionally or all the or more often than not foregoing consumption for future return, everybody benefits in the whole without them being forced to do so.
Okay. Absolutely. I
agree. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I like that you are likening that to investment, right? Because some people would say, oh, well, that sounds like sacrifice to me.
And it does. But education is an investment.
Right, right, right. Absolutely.
Especially the way you characterize it, Brett, more so than the way the state characterizes, because the state characterizes it in a way that the hominins of indoctrination and education are the same for them, which is the opposite of what your notion is.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, oh, and that perfect place to return back to John Dewey as well. Speaking of education. So I was really surprised from what I knew about Dewey that when Thaddeus Russell told me he loved World War One. He was like standing up in applause for World War One.
Wow.
Now it couldn't make more sense, because what that offered in a society that was, you know, splitting into all these different directions with the, I think at that time, the second wave of immigration from Europe and really the lack of this cohesion around, you know, or not around, but underneath state power. Yes, here's what we need. This will not only give people you know, something to look to back at the center of everything, but it will also produce this great regimentation of the entire society. I mean, when I became politically aware, George W. Bush, I mean, I had like, you know, I flirted with political awareness before that, but when I became politically aware to stay, George W. Bush was president and the left was anti-war. Right? That's not even true. 5 years after he left office, I can't believe I fell for that like I did. War is so important to the progressive ideology,
yes.
If for
yes.
no other reason than it produces a regimented society.
Exhibit A, when the Vietnam War was in full force and all the protests from the left were happening, what happened to all the anti-war protests when conscription went away? It dissolved.
Right. Right, absolutely.
I would love to debate Thaddeus Russell, by the way, on World War One. And if Thaddeus is listening, I'd like to say, sir, I'd like to invite you to a cordial and gentlemanly debate on why World War One was not only the turning point for America going into the moral dumpster, but it was probably the one grappling hook that progressivism needed to get its claws and tentacles into every orifice of official American society and make it the official state religion.
Yeah, and obviously it was only exacerbated by World War II. Our most recent show together was actually called Behold the Dictator, and it's drawing the parallels between Nazi Germany and New Deal America. But he's talking about, what was his name? Hugh Johnson, the guy who, he was part of FDR's brain trust and his origins in World War One, with this dragnet that they did. They're like, look, either work or fight, right? You'll either have a job that we deem to be respectable, right? So talk about getting the tentacles into everything. Like, you will either do some kind of vocation that some council determines. This is America.
I would urge your audience to look up, they can start page or Google this, whatever they use, something called the American Protective League. That was a Wilsonian creation to hunt down, ravage, fine, kidnap, and cage anti-war protesters, anarchists, and anybody who was thinking out of the box during World War One.
Oh, absolutely. And then we have the Espionage Act, like all temperance,
yes.
Like all these things that just seem, you know, as far as how we get history in government school, if you even ever hear about these things, just kind of like these disconnected events and not all aspects of the same ideology of control.
You know, Mark Twain was a fervent anti-imperialist at the end of the 19th century. And then we see a lot of anti-imperialist notions with the Taft Party, with the Taft wing of the Republican Party and such. Pat Buchanan still carries that flame today in a magazine called The American Conservative. Mm-hmm. But what you also discover is that Lindbergh was going to run against Red D.R. in 1940. What would the world have looked like if America had not entered World War II? And also, I wanted to point out that I would consider, as an amateur historian, that World War I and World War II are the same conflict.
Yeah, absolutely, with a 20-year détente, right?
I mean, and what would have happened if the Central Powers, in a limited conflict, had not only managed to, where Germany doesn't lose, but Germany achieves a stalemate, and the Western Powers, represented by the UK and the US at the time, surrender, what would have happened? You know, Hitler might have been a second-rate Austrian art dealer, and that iron train that took Lenin to author the Bolshevik Revolution and really put the iron fist behind it may not have occurred at all. This is sheerly speculative and counterfactual, but it really brings up a lot of points of what would have happened. What if we hadn't embraced this deadly progressive instrument to increase corpse piles?
I've always kind of put it on the U.S. entry into World War One, where it appeared that in Europe they were going to essentially fight to a stalemate or a status quo antebellum, right? And then the United States entry obviously makes it lopsided. You have the Versailles Treaty that really sets things moving in Germany. And then all you had to wait for was enough time for a new generation to grow into adults and learn how to handle guns to replace all the people who had died in the First World War, and they were ready to fight again.
There's always U.S. provocations, whether it's the Lusitania World War One, whether it's Pearl Harbor World War Two, whether it's the Pacific Ocean incident that occurred off the coast of Vietnam in 1964, those kind of things. You know, there's two interesting things I want to bring up about this. In World War One, you'll notice that when a division fought in World War One in Europe, what it did is fought as the 1st Alabama or the 2nd Massachusetts, whatever the case may be. Do you notice that in World War II, those identifying markers of American division strength, or whatever the case may be, it was the 82nd Airborne, which was the All-Americans. There was no state-flagged regiment or division that fought during World War II, because what the Mandarins of World War II did is they looked back at World War I, they said, you know what, we haven't quite made these guys fight for a national identity. We were still making them fight for a regional identity or a state identity. We need to nationalize that identity so that we can make these state lines, these provincial lines, transparent in the way they apprehend the world, and that they're not fighting for Alabama, they're fighting for America. And then, of course, that march has continued forward psychologically over time.
Oh, absolutely, and accelerated from there. I mean, it was such a powerful and impactful event that really made so much of what you're talking about concrete. You know, and I think that from that generation on. And certainly, like, even if progressives or liberals, people on the left, I don't like to say people on the left, but people, you know, people who are Democrats and liberals, even if they claim to be anti-war today, they look back with this great reverence, right, for that period of time, for Wilson, and obviously for FDR, right?
So, oh my gosh, you're right.
There is that is locked in. Really through World War II, and it has been very, very difficult to undo. I don't think there's been enough of an effort to undo it yet, but
a childlike reverence for the power of the state. And you'll see that Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler were all persons of the year, men of the year in the 1930s on Time magazine.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. Absolutely. And they had so much in common. And man, were they just, I don't know how much, it went from Roosevelt to Mussolini and Hitler. I haven't found much on that. But Mussolini and Hitler both, a lot of applause going Roosevelt's way in the 1930s for sure. And
well,
obviously,
I would urge your audience, Brett, to investigate the Venona transcripts, which shows just how Swiss cheesed by communist influence agents and active agents during World War II the White House was. There wasn't a thing that Red D.R. and his advisors couldn't do that wasn't transmitted to the Kremlin. Harry Hopkins and Harry Dexter White were both active Soviet agents during the entirety of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I would say I think that's really valuable. And that was an important new perspective for me when I was I did a series a while ago about communist infiltrations into the United States, both during and after World War One and during and after World War Two. And this might have been the boogeyman that everyone was like, something's wrong, and everyone's shining flashlights and walking around with magnifying glass. What is it? Is it gays? Is it blacks? Is it communists? And what it really was the ideology of collectivism taking hold in the United States. So, I mean, like after World War One, we have the first Red Scare. We see this resurgence of the Klan. But post-World War II with McCarthyism, it's really, really focused on communism. They're also Corneille Films is making, instructional videos about how teen boys should fight off homosexuals. So like there's this hypervigilance, right? And nobody really seems to know. I mean, maybe they're on the right track, that they're getting warmer in the second Red Scare. Not that I'm defending McCarthyism, but that it was this ideology of collectivism that was basically taking over. And the wars were a great time for that to happen. Thaddeus Russell, Noam Chomsky, and Richard Grove from Peace Revolution Podcast and Tragedy and Hope have all spent a lot of time talking about the infiltration, or maybe not so much Thaddeus Russell, but definitely Chomsky and Richard Grove, the infiltration of the British, you know, the British intelligence forces into the United States, really around World War One. And it wasn't an accident that all of this happened, that there were British operatives dealing with American government officials and American intellectuals saying, this is why war is good. You know, we're collapsing. We'd like to use you as our new spear, United States, because you're still strong and capable, and you haven't been, you know, exhausted by 300 years of imperial overstretch like we have. So
I have so many things to talk about with what you've just described, that we should do another show together if I were honored by an invitation to do so.
Yeah, let's.
And I would love to talk about that, because there is so much to discuss when it comes to that. Because I've characterized World War II as the war to save Joseph Stalin, because basically the entire White House effort during the entirety of World War II was to make part of the planet safe for communism and its expansion, when you look at it in hindsight.
Yeah, that is a great soundbite too, to make the world safe for communism, because I mean it wasn't just even operationally, it was ideological.
It was the war to save Joseph Stalin.
I really like that. Yeah, we should do that. And before we wrap up today, when we were just exchanging emails and making a plan here, you were talking about a historical context for home education that you thought was important. And I wanted to just spend the last 10 or 15 minutes here making sure we make that extra explicit for people.
I'd love to. The historical context that we have is that, look, people have heard me say that secession is the rule and not the exception in the way history rhymes over time in Western civilization.
Right.
I would say that home education is, and by the way, thank you for correcting me. I'm not saying homeschooling.
Sure.
Home education over the entirety of Western civilization is the rule and not the exception. What we're taught in the education gulags is that it's always been done this way. The Pavlovian bells, the insistence that you do as we wish, the insistence that you take all these drugs, the insistence that you study what we want you to, and the insistence that you read your history in the way that we want it to happen. This is the exception. This is a Deweyism. This is a progressive institution that's maybe 150 years old, and it's become monolithic in the U.S. in the past 100 years. But home education, and this very notion that parents have not only a moral obligation, but an investment return on ensuring that their children sort of capture who the parents are as human beings, and they pass this on to their children, so that once those parents do go on to their reward, their children are sort of being, I hate to use the word viral, but they are sort of being the viral vector of remembrance, the viral vector of who you were as a parent, whether good or bad, unfortunately, but who you were as a parent. And that's one of the primary investment philosophical things that we have to do as parents. So home education, even if people are neglectful enough, and I do think it's neglectful, and maybe even abusive to send your children to a government gulag, if they're not paying attention to their children in the evenings or the weekends, or guiding them in books and getting television out of the house. We don't allow video games, for instance, in the house, and haven't since our children were small. If they don't do that, I think they're robbing their children of this 5,000-year very noble lineage of autonomous education of children, so they could become responsible adults as a result of the household they're from and not the state they belong to.
Right. And the challenge there that I'm really trying to draw attention to is a generational momentum. Because it's not like my parents, who, you know, probably considering the trends in public education, might have had a better, excuse me, public education, what the hell? Government school. I still do that. You see, it's the programming is tricky. Might have had a more educational government school experience than I did, just following the trends of government school downward. But they weren't educated. I was having a conversation with my father, like within the last year. He's like, "Can you really teach logic?" Yeah. Yeah, it's like a whole college course. But that idea was foreign to him. And, you know, I remember being a boy and listening to him talk to me about politics and talk to me about Ronald Reagan when I was like, Ronald Reagan was president until I was like 10, maybe. And thinking he knew so much, and he's a smart guy, like he's good at what he does. But he was so clueless about, you know, the political and historical world. And I was lucky to be born now to be able to encounter the things when I did. And I guess to a certain extent, have the intellect and the motivation to free myself from that. But most people are not doing that. What chance did my dad have? What were his parents like? They were schooled by the government as well. So we're talking now five or six generations, more than that, maybe seven or eight generations of government school graduates, right?
So and you know, the worst part of this, Brett, is that right here, right now, the world you and I inhabit in 2014, vertically and horizontally, we have access to more human information than ever any human who has ever trod the earth since they just came out of the caves. Yet we don't see the innovation. We don't see the deep thinking, the critical thinking, the engineering marvels, the scientific marvels, all this kind of stuff. And of course, it's because a lot of that has been arrested by the state. But if there is to be a golden age for home education, we're there right now.
I could not agree more.